Still, the rift between our instructors and us got worse. Before class, one of the instructors slammed a stack of papers on my desk. "Here, Gary, hand out these papers. It's the perfect job for you." "Anything, sir, to help out a fellow federal employee," I said, like the brat I was. "If you give it out, you've got to be able to take it." And I handed out the packets to each student with a smile. Our instructor walked out, and I sat down and flipped through the packet. I gasped at the last page. It was a sheet with the names of every person in our class, with our social security numbers and salaries. "What the F?" someone said. "Do you see this?" I asked my friend Jimmy, who'd also transferred from UD. He nodded in astonishment as each person caught wind of the final page. "Jimmy, grab those up. I'm going to go get this guy," I said, and I ran through the hallway. "Excuse me, sir. Sir, do you realize what you just did?" I was trying to help him out so he could get ahead of his own jam. "Mr. Byrne, get back in that classroom. I've had enough shit from you." "All right, but I'm just trying to help you. Are you sure you don't want to hear me out?" "I don't need your help," he said bitterly, and looked me dead in the eye. I returned to the classroom. Everyone was losing their minds. Some of the guys had entered FAMS at less than $50,000 from the Army after having served multiple combat tours, but guys from the UD, the Defense Department, and the Park Police had better leverage to transfer. They were already in the federal pay scale system and had rank. The military was a different system. Many of the guys were furious to be paid $20,000 less than both me and a former UD ERT sergeant. But we had 12 years or more in federal law enforcement. The sergeant earned $10,000 more than I. Some were concentrating on the discrepancies in pay. Others saw this as a ploy for that instructor to trip us or divide our class into petty grievances. Each person had his or her cell phone out, contacting allies outside the chain of command. One Army veteran even phoned his congressman. Our team leader finally was catching on and marched us all to the special agent in charge's office. Technically, we were skipping class. Though the instructor tried to hold us back, our team leader pushed us through. I'll never forget the SAC's face when he saw the final page. He turned 10 sheets of red. The entire day of training was screwed over for HR damage control. Needless to say, it was a major disaster, dividing classmates for the rest of our training and deepening the wedge between us all and FAMS leadership. Eventually, we completed our training at Artesia, New Mexico, and it was off to Atlantic City's Federal Air Marshal Service Training Center for the next phase in training. The Atlantic City Training Center staff had its head on straighter, but it wasn't without drama. Of our starting class of 40 trainees, some couldn't hack the physicality or the stress and washed out. I was 40 when I went through the school. Some young guys thought they could take it, but they couldn't keep a steady pace for a two-miler or couldn't handle someone throwing them down on the mat room. No one washed out for marksmanship, which was astonishing. Some of our class were terrible marksmen. But it was a serious blight on setting and keeping standards, the character of our leadership, and our piss-poor instructors. They were passing the buck to the field offices, which set a nasty precedent. Yet one guy who didn't make it through FAMS was an inspiration, and I'll never forget him. I'll call him Barnett. He was on active reserve in the Marines, and his unit got called up. He could have finagled his way out of it, since he was in training for a federal law enforcement agency. But he had trained with his Marine unit, and to him, they were family. He felt a great sense of loyalty to them, the Marines, our country, and the mission. He said he would go through school all over again after this next tour in the War on Terror. Men like that don't do it for the money. They do it for the mission. When I was working alongside him, he reminded me of situations where commitment was either 100% or not, even with no guarantee of either success or of life itself. I graduated from Atlantic City's training center and even took home a marksmanship and shooting award. I was among the top five shooters, but the four guys above me, Barnett included, were far beyond my skill level. Those four trainees were so lightning fast that we couldn't see them move. When you looked at their shot timers, they all read less than a second. Their paper targets were hit in such a tight group, they looked like a single 410 bore shotgun hit, that you thought they had missed their follow-up shots. These guys were some former Special Forces pros, true warriors, because they had been on the two-way range in the War on Terror and in other conflicts. I'm proud of my marksmanship award. It's a memento of my skills. But so many of my colleagues humbled me by their service and heroism. They gave me great strength and kept my ego in check. By my August 2003 graduation, 40% of new air marshals going to their field offices were failing their first qualifier, the Practical Pistol Course, PPC, and therefore couldn't fly. And we shrugged it off as if it were normal. And even the PPC was heavily dumbed down from its former standards. My fellow qualifying air marshals would sarcastically say, "But hey, fly safe," no differently than an Army vet might raise an eyebrow when witnessing similar bad policy and cynically say, "Safety number one." Worse, our field offices were under too much pressure and were having the failing FNGs, freaking new guys, fly missions while still on probation. Never is the mission so important to screw it up. After our transition from training school to our field office, we stood ready to deter and to combat hijackings, bombings, and attacks on our commercial air traffic by all means possible that don't hinder or deter Americans from traveling and maintaining a healthy economy. After all, the 9/11 attacks were as much an attack on our economy and way of life as they were designed to inflict mass casualties or destroy command structure and real estate. The President and Congress agreed on that policy. FAMS leadership was to implement the policy, and we, the boots on the ground, or in the air, were to make it actuality. I was flying missions just a few days later from the field office covering Philadelphia International Airport. Tensions ran high. We were sure, we felt it in our bones, that more attacks, bombings, and hijackings were coming our way. Most laypersons think it's been all quiet since 9/11. They're dead wrong. That myth drives us crazy. It's the great irony of our national security personnel, from the swords to the shields, that if we do our jobs right, no one hears about it. The best umpire in the league is one you never notice. But if we don't do our jobs right, it's the USS Cole, Beirut, Oklahoma City, or even Benghazi all over again. Today we're doing a tremendous job, but we're at a crossroads. Since, and even before 9/11, the United States has been constantly probed for weaknesses, from both terrorist groups and full-bore state-run attacks. I initiated my FAMS duty with domestic return overnight, RON missions, typically two-day missions, fly, stay, and then fly back. I had negotiated my transition to FAMS to be based out of Philly International. I wanted to raise my family where I grew up and to have my kids' grandmother be part of their lives. When I was starting out, the usual trips were Philly-Miami, with D.C. in the middle, Philly-Charlotte, or Philly-Los Angeles, followed by an office day, then a day off. The day after that, I was back flying missions. Sometimes we'd have two office days in a row, or an occasional training school for explosive detection and disarmament, in case I ever had a Jack Bauer-style moment disarming a ticking time bomb. These training schools were always amazing because our tactical renaissance development was moving so far, a development that gets the bad guy dead and the good guy home with fewer casualties. As the old military adage goes, if you're in a fair fight, you're doing it wrong. At 41, as a new air marshal, I was high-strung and eager, for two reasons. Jenny and I had sold our house in Maryland and were, as if college kids, living with our parents until we could acquire a house to raise our family. Further weighing on my mind, even in 2003, were our country's three wars, Afghanistan, Iraq, and the less defined but equally crucial global war on terror. In Iraq, we had just shifted from invasion to policing and counterinsurgency. I still hated the image in my mind of Congress, along with Hillary, standing on the Congress steps, singing the national anthem, knowing they had effed us with petty BS that left us so vulnerable leading up to 9/11. In Tom Quinn's infinite wisdom, FAMS policy mandated we wear a suit and tie. We also pre-boarded the aircraft in our positions ahead of all passengers. For most jobs, dressing professionally is a great thing, but not for undercover work. Board before the first-class passengers, and it was extremely obvious who the undercover air marshals were, the a-holes who looked like Secret Service agent wannabes. Being undercover was supposed to thwart the same terrorist threat that fought to the cockpit on 9/11. They were clandestine operators too, after all, and they dressed subtly. They didn't go around wearing I Love Radical Islam t-shirts. But with Quinn's goal of appearance of strength, rather than actual strength, we would be easily identifiable to terrorists. They'd take us out and then take our weapons. It endangered not just our lives, it endangered the entire mission. It made it easier for a 9/11 to happen again. We even had passengers thank us for our service when they boarded and as they stowed their bags overhead. Normally, getting thanks as a cop or military guy is great, but for us as air marshals, it made us feel as though we had a giant target on our backs, throats, and major arteries for any contraband razor blade, garrote wire, sleeper hold, or sharpened toothbrush shank hastily crafted in the bathroom. Our protection plans worked only if we could maintain our cover identities as just other passengers. It was a farce. FAMS's micromanaging policies jeopardized everything. It was all about appearances and portraying air marshals like hotshot agents. It was moronic. Sometimes, when we were pre-boarding, flight attendants and pilots would give us the rundown of the plane and show us the under areas and nuances of the specific aircraft. That was great and helped foster the bond of our being in this together to maintain international air traffic security. But on one pre-boarding, our pilot, a retired Air Force pilot, pulled me aside and gave me a piece of his mind about how unprofessional and stupid the air marshals were. He referred to us as "you guys." I just bit my tongue until he ran out of breath, or I could get a word in. I appreciated the old-school military-style critique, made me a little nostalgic even. I knew he wasn't going to stop until he got winded. "You G-damn air marshals are costing us millions," he exclaimed, berating us for checking everything and holding up flights an extra 30 minutes. "You're not bomb-sniffing dogs. What the hell are you searching for?" I didn't know either. Some planes had their nuances, but this was clearly a policy adapted by the Secret Service for pre-checking hotels. The pilot continued bitching about how obvious we were to everyone, and in reality, how we didn't do a damn thing to keep anyone safe. He took a breath. "Are you done?" I asked, letting him wipe the sweat off his forehead and breathe. He was, so I leveled with him. "I hear you, and I agree with you. I'm just the air marshal. I don't like the policy, nor do I set the policy, any more than you do. I just follow it. Believe it or not, I'm actually a new guy here. Yeah, I've only joined just recently, and all I can say is the air marshals are trying to work through it. It'll get fixed, but it's going to take a while." I didn't mention a reason, but gestured upward so he could read between the lines. It was all so ridiculous, and it ruined my agency. Many air marshals sidestepped agency brass to air their complaints to legislators, and even to anonymously leak stories to the press. If it took embarrassing FAMS management to save its mission and lives, then guys would do that. Behavioral detection was one policy that did get adapted eventually, and I loved that. It became just like what the USSSUD did at checkpoints. "Nervous?" I'd ask someone with a smile, as I watched their posture to see if it stayed the same or fluctuated, if they went into some elaborate story, if they got defensive for no reason at all, or if they were consistent within their cultural or religious norms. The 9/11 hijackers were divided into groups of four, with one trained pilot and three other terrorists armed with crude melee weapons, some hand-to-hand training, and the will to kill and succeed at the expense of their own lives. I was looking for someone like myself, someone who is mentally and physically prepared to succeed in his or her political mission by killing and even giving his or her life if necessary. The difference between them and me is that if I succeeded, everyone who boarded the plane would walk off alive. If they succeeded, 300-plus people would be dead. I harbored no snow-white illusions of what the plane was going to look like if a hijacker and I tangled. It was going to be ugly and bloody, and it would make passengers want to vomit. If I did exactly what our protocol and training dictated, it was going to be a mess. I'd conditioned my mind for it. I did that as I trained at CrossFit. I did it each morning as I reminded myself why I had my firearm in the first place. But I'd be lying if I said that the mental conditioning didn't take a toll. Premeditating to kill someone places a ghastly burden on the mind and even on the body. The underwear bomber and the shoe bomber failed because they sweated through their bombs. The underwear bomber was so incredibly nervous that he decided to wear the bomb 3 weeks before his mission, and that's how he ruined it. He was willing, and he tried to kill a plane full of people, but what he actually did was burn his crotch off. There happened to be a Swedish documentary filmmaker several seats over. When he saw the fire and the bomber fiddling with his explosive, the Swede hopped over seats from the other side of the plane and beat the crap out of him. Other passengers joined in. Those passengers didn't have to be embroiled with the fatigue and stress of mentally preparing for a fight, because they never planned on it. They didn't think, they acted. But the underwear bomber was thinking and emotionally compromised, and failed. I wish I could tell you that it was some FBI Mosk undercover agent, cyber team, or TSA or FAMS agent who stopped him. Nope. It was his own sweat because of the emotional burden of his mission. In 1991, a Tamil Tiger, radical Sri Lankan terrorist, the bra bomber, actually it was a belt, didn't sweat through her bomb, though, and she accomplished her goal, assassinating Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Ratna Gandhi. She was ruthless. My partner and I once homed in on a passenger, and we were so keyed on him that when he entered the bathroom, I took my in-flight magazine and placed my gun underneath it. When everything panned out without incident, I figured no harm, no foul. Many air marshals at the time were similarly hyper-aware. We believed a hit was coming any damn day. Since 2003, we started to refocus and retrain. I've heard stories, though, of how after 9/11, higher-ups were basically handing firearms to those transferring to FAMS and saying, get on the plane. Things have greatly improved since then, but I fear the pendulum is swinging both ways. I believed in the FAMS mission, and we needed to stay vigilant. In the years that followed, many air marshals like myself, who still held the mission-first mentality, knew we had to pick and choose our battles carefully. Otherwise, mid-level management was going to stick its neck out to put ours on the chopping block. We couldn't be the guys who were always saber-rattling and rocking the boat. But when we did, they knew to take us seriously. One guy, bless him, pushed management's micromanaging back into their smug faces. Our dress code was professional coat and tie. But as in the movie My Cousin Vinny, one air marshal bought a very old red formal suit with coattails. But I'm still in dress code, he retorted to management, and he was. No one likes a stink, but sometimes stinks have to be made. Management was either going to have to fight him, citing protocol, change the protocol to let us dress undercover, or make the dress code worse, so that we really would look like U.S. Secret Service or FBI G-men, with a typical men in black monochrome suit and tie, shades, earpiece. But if they wrote him up, they were going to have to air grievances on paper. Eventually, after several other air marshals banded together in a series of hilariously dressed stunts, management caved. We no longer pre-boarded and could finally dress the way we best deemed fit the mission. Our dress code became to simply blend in. A suit from Philly to Boston may have been fine, but from Philly to Miami, it garnered attention. It was clear at both our training schools, at our Philly field office, and from hearing from my old classmates and other field offices, that FAMS pervasively discriminated against women and minorities. It created a crossfire. Management at every level pledged to wipe that shit up and out, but management's solution was the constant political appearance-based solution. They created protected classes, as we called them, while routing out diversity of thought and performance-based competition. Instead of leaderships digging deep, creating tough standards, and holding everyone equally accountable, they played games. The worst game was making our qualifications pass-fail rather than score-based, because management could not pass the older Sky Marshal standards of marksmanship and physicality. If an Air Marshal can't do a pull-up or 35 push-ups in a minute, will they really be able to fight to the death against someone committed to dying to succeed in taking down a plane? Hell no. I have to say it. For some middle management and a select few, the Federal Air Marshal Program has become a shining example of the worst government welfare I can think of. Former Secret Service special agents used FAMS as a way to pay into and collect on a second pension from the same U.S. Treasury, double-dipping because they came from the old D.C. Police and Fire retirement program before President Reagan instituted the federal employee retirement system. What made matters worse is that so many former SAs treated their new full-time FAMS jobs like part-time gigs. Supervisors often clocked in late and left early. FAMS's system of pay and timekeeping was designed to leech hours for employees so that more personnel had to be hired. I flew on a plane. I had a ticketed flight and set schedule that they gave me at a set hotel that I had to get approved. So why was it necessary that I logged my hours and got them approved on the back end too? It was not only unnecessary, but it was made far too complicated purposely. If you've seen the NBC television series The Office or Jennifer Aniston's movie Office Space, you've seen what our office days looked like. I'm dead serious. It was criminal, but I was mandated to play the game. Here's how ridiculous it got. I was on an overseas mission, and what did I see proudly displayed on my hotel wall? Customer of the Month, the Federal Air Marshal Service. What the hell? Could you imagine an undercover law enforcement officer being outed because of that? Who bought into that? Meanwhile, an air marshal who put his schedule on his family fridge got fired over it. To politicians, the problem was actually perception, not the problem itself, not what actually jeopardized the mission. For me on an airplane and in any undercover work, it was true that I didn't want operators who looked like cookie-cutter, slimmed-out, Caucasian-only men. But it was just as damned dangerous to hire people based on gender and skin color. Performance standards and accountability applied to everyone. We needed FAMs worthy of trust and confidence to complete the mission. It was the only way to fight crime and terrorism. Character for us had no appearance except for a look of general athleticism. On the flip side, there were air marshals who needed seatbelt extenders, because they were too obese to use the regular airplane belts. One air marshal nagged management so much that they allowed him to carry a SIG P239, a much smaller version of our pistol, which meant our cartridge magazines weren't compatible. Management at HQ were complaining that the SIG P229 made them look fat. Right, blame the gun. So they instituted the SIG P239 for themselves. Then they had to accommodate all the other whiners, too. Then, anyone who was overweight or inconvenienced by carrying the standard issue got to carry the smaller pistol with half the amount of standard ammunition. Not that the original whiner could shoot the broadside of a barn, no matter whether he had a bandolier full of ammo. If you can't raise the bridge, lower the water. If you can't meet the standards, well, just lower them. Another air marshal couldn't stay awake in a meeting, let alone on an airplane. I'm no doctor, but he had horrible sleep apnea, to the point where even the flight attendants found it irksome. Management refused to bench him or hold him accountable. It was like having a lifeguard who couldn't swim. If we didn't laugh, we'd cry. But I finally had to shut up about it, even though I was fuming. The ugly truth is that so much of middle management had lost sight of the mission. They truly didn't believe another attack on a plane would happen. That was their mentality. They often used checkride flights that are made to verify in-flight air marshal performance as transparent excuses to visit friends or for family events like weddings or vacations. While many air marshals were hard chargers, management had created an everyone's a winner, everyone gets a participation trophy mentality. Protected classes were a lost cause. Management was so worried about HR grievances that I knew an air marshal who refused to get the quarterly physical. FAMS actually hired an independent review board to create a minimum standard for us. They spent thousands of dollars on it. The board settled on 3 pull-ups, a mile and a half in 15 minutes, and 35 push-ups in a minute. That was abysmally low. Does that level of fitness indicate someone's being able to fight 4 9/11 style hijackers? No. But FAMS didn't even enforce this standard, so we really didn't have any. And there was zero incentive for an individual air marshal to comply, other than one's own self-respect and sense of duty. I couldn't live with myself if I let a tragedy occur. We had a protected class female air marshal who weaseled her way into a promotion to become an airport liaison by insinuating, really threatening, to file a discrimination lawsuit. I'm just glad I didn't have to fly with her often because she wasn't on my team. I discussed her with the air marshals I knew from other countries. Foreign air marshals could spot our flaws from a mile away and laughed at us. The Germans, for example, had an excellent program. They were impressed by her case. "Don't even get me started," I'd say. "Don't you have fitness standards?" they'd ask in their various accents. And I'd shake my head, and they'd laugh and shake theirs. "I can't talk about it. She'll file a grievance against me. So just drop it." Foreign air marshals could sense our own marshals' disdain for our system's abusers. FAMS management's lack of professionalism stemmed from persons of weak character attaining key leadership positions. Lower-level slip-ups occurred when higher-ups junked the principle of leading by example. It led to misconduct, such as marshals hiring prostitutes on foreign trips, wasting tax dollars, and overlooking outright corruption. FAMS recently made the papers after a pilot kicked an air marshal off his plane. The marshal had threatened to sue over not being offered the same meals as others and groused that a drink was deliberately spilled on him. As time passed, even expert instructors who had been active combat Army Rangers, Navy SEALs, Delta Force, and other special forces type operations abandoned FAMS. They could no longer stand the pattern of constant administrative back and forth and broken promises. It had become routine for us, but they, as private contractors, could work anywhere, and soon did. FAMS simply couldn't retain anyone with their level of craftsmanship, not with FAMS's slipshod character and too often scrambled priorities. Just about anyone can learn to shoot and to teach others to shoot, at least in ideal conditions. But the know-how to shoot and fight under the worst imaginable situations, gun jams, taking fire, injuries, dynamic positioning, is incredibly difficult. You can't put a price tag on it. Those experts who departed FAMS in disgust taught from hard-knock, real-life experiences, and FAMS tried to nickel and dime them while wasting precious resources on free college tuition for anyone in FAMS who wanted it. Leadership, frankly, treated those expert outside contractors like shit, trying to insult them as much as possible. It was damned upsetting, to say the least, to see qualified people like that move on. FAMS's management thrift with outside instructors was exacerbated by its wastefully piling on the paperwork and make-work during Marshall's office days. FAMS played catch-up for a long time. It wasn't all FAMS' fault. For too long, Congress and the nation itself failed to recognize the terrorist threat facing us. It shouldn't have taken a 9/11 to wake us up, but it did. But the appointment of Tom Quinn as the modernized FAMS's first director only worsened matters. His misplaced priorities and feather-bedding for old Secret Service cronies turned an essential program into an almost instant national laughingstock. A hasty, get-it-done mentality didn't work for FAMS any better than it worked for Hillary Clinton. Tom Quinn resigned in early 2006. his absurd dress code and pre-boarding policies caught up with him. In June 2015, acting TSA Director Melvin Carraway resigned after reports that agency undercover red teams assigned to several airports had failed to detect bombs and guns in a frightening 67 out of 70 tests conducted by the Department of Homeland Security's Office of the Inspector General. I had to ask myself, so why were the people who failed at that rate getting paid to begin with? But the go-to congressional solution was to do two things: dump more money into the problem, and send a cosmetic message that the problem would be solved by a high-level resignation. I wish it were that simple, but the next director will be part of the same in-crowd. Healing in this case requires an enema, not a Band-Aid. I joined FAMS to accomplish a vital mission. I joined to halt terrorism in its tracks, hopefully even before a situation unfolds. I wanted to exceed the level of commitment displayed by four-person-plus teams of trained and committed hijackers. Anything short of that just wasn't good enough. Why should Americans pay me, or anyone else, for anything less than that? Let me tell you exactly what it would look like if a trained, committed air marshal had to do their job on an airplane against a four-person-plus hijacking team. The human body pumps blood incredibly fast, and 9/11's hijacking team cut into a few people to make examples of them. They killed the pilots because the terrorist trained as a pilot could assume control of the flight deck. Imagine the smell, the blood-soaked carpets, the screams, the volume of noise in the airplane, the panic, as nearly 300 people were scared stiff and hopping over their seats and running as best they could in a crowded airplane to get away from people killing other people. Now imagine that you're an air marshal with an obese, asthmatic, sleep apnea-ridden partner. Now imagine that you're an air marshal who's been outed by agency dress code and pre-boarding policies, and who, because of that, has had his or her firearm stolen. Imagine what it would take to be an air marshal who has to retake the flight deck. Imagine the marksmanship and brutality it would take to battle those four or more hijackers, fanatics all, and accidentally shoot one or more of the passengers or flight attendants or pilots fighting for their lives and trying to barricade themselves in the cockpit. Imagine the concussive force of firing a weapon in a pressurized tube at an altitude of 30,000 feet at 530 miles per hour, except that maybe you're really not at 30,000 feet and 530 miles per hour. You're losing altitude rapidly while gaining immense speed as the co-pilot puts the plane into a dive and swerves to thwart the attackers as he or she tries to make an emergency landing anywhere, no matter how dangerous it is, possible. Imagine that the terrorist pilot is armed and firing down the aisles, using them as fatal funnels. Imagine the level of fitness, situational awareness, and yes, violence that you would need to hold the flight deck. Terrorists use women and children because sometimes they are women and children. By the time the threat reached the aircraft, we air marshals would have at best maybe 7 seconds to identify the threat for what it was and to take action. I knew that I was going to want to vomit. I knew that my adrenaline was going to give me the highest dosage immediately, but the airplane was going to go from complete calm to complete hell in an instant. That's what each federal air marshal is hired to face. FAMS was created to be an onboard shield against a terrorist spear. Terrorists know that they only have to get it right once for their mission to succeed. But the Federal Air Marshal Service leadership and middle management had so obviously lost sight of their agency's mission. September 11 wasn't the first attack on airplanes, not by a long shot. And it hasn't been the last, not by a long shot either. Any air marshal who falls short of matching that threat shouldn't be an air marshal. It's that simple. Otherwise, passengers would be better off knowing that it's up to them, just as Todd Beamer knew when he retook United Flight 93 on 9/11, on the intel that he and his fellow passengers had received that their terrorist attackers had embarked on a suicide mission. Beamer, a regular American, an exceptional American hero, spoke up before retaking that airplane and taking it down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, saving thousands of lives at the terrorists' still unknown target. Are you ready? Okay, let's roll, were Todd Beamer's last words before storming the deck. Are we ready to roll? Think of Navy diver Robert Steedham, who who stood up to terrorists when they hijacked TWA Flight 847 in June 1985. He took that risk because he knew his fellow military hostages were all married and he wasn't. His captors pummeled him and shot him in his right temple before dumping his dead body from the plane and then shooting him again for good measure. Think of Flight 847's German-American flight attendant, Yuli Derrickson, who, after trying to protect Steedham, stood up to the terrorist who had just killed him. When the terrorists demanded she identify the several Jewish passengers on board, she refused and hid their passports. I thought of heroism like that when I was training or at work to focus my thoughts and recall just why I did what I did. We've been there before. We shouldn't have to be there again. Let's also acknowledge this. Despite all the crap from our top-heavy, lead-from-behind management, the boots on the airplane floor, the air marshals, have succeeded since 9/11 in safeguarding American air travel. And because of that, terrorists have had to change their playbook. FAMS has made our domestic and international airplane travel a hard target. They have succeeded again and again in thwarting attacks. Can another 9/11 happen? It will happen, but because of air marshals dedicated to their mission and your safety, the next catastrophic terrorist hijacking attempt won't go without a major fight at 30,000 feet. But, and this is a big but, we know exactly what the terrorist threat has evolved into. Al-Qaeda, ISIS, Boko Haram, or even a crazy lone wolf. I hate that term. They're not wolves, they're jackals. Or a four-person-plus coordinated assault. The enemy selects a target based on two criteria. First, it's soft. It can be attacked. It is attackable. Second, attacking that target will wreak the most psychological havoc on our population to influence its national leadership in an intended political direction. It's that simple. They will absolutely select public places such as malls. We saw that in the September 2013 Westgate Mall attack in Nairobi, Kenya, by Al-Shabaab, which killed 63 persons, injured over 175 more, crippled the Kenyan tourist economy, and locked down the city of Nairobi entirely. Attacks may resemble the six highly coordinated simultaneous attacks in November 2008 in Mumbai, India, most notably at the Taj Mahal Palace Hotel. 157 innocent souls were murdered. More than 600 people were injured by the series of gunfights and bombings. Any country is vulnerable to mass murder from radical Islamic terrorism. That was proven once again in Paris in January 2015, as terrorists attacked the weekly satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, as well as a kosher deli. That November, terrorists coordinated six more attacks on the French capital, striking at a major concert hall, a stadium, bars, and restaurants. They massacred 146 innocent human beings. The attacks crippled French tourism. Why did these attacks happen? Why were those targets chosen? Simply because they fit the two criteria I just listed. One, they were soft targets, and two, they created a psychological impact followed by a policy impact. Think of it as Murphy's Law, or Burns' Law on Security. Any attack that can happen will. But an attack in the United States will so obviously include schools and public arenas because we still haven't gotten our act together in protecting what matters most. It's happened before, yet we still don't learn. It will happen at the White House because we still haven't learned. I know from the We Hate You book in my FAMS field office. It's the latest intel, basically a list of the latest threats. I know it all too well. Yes, I believe in the FAMS mission, and I believe it's working, but the agency has to update its counterterrorism techniques to meet terrorism's evolving tactics. We must harden our targets at home and take the fight to the enemy abroad. But when terrorists turn on our news, what do they see? A man lands a gyrocopter on Congress's lawn without interference. A knife-wielding man runs unchecked into the White House, right past all its beefy security. In Atlanta, a man carrying a gun is allowed onto an elevator carrying President Obama. Those last two incidents cost Secret Service Director Julia Pearson her job in October 2014. I have high hopes for her replacement, Joe Clancy, since I worked with Joe many times for many hours in USS SUD. Leadership doesn't come from the bottom up or the top down. Leadership with character comes from the top down after someone has served from the bottom up. I think Joe Clancy can turn the mentality around. Terrorists can recognize the difference between actual security and its mere appearance. You think they can't see past a gun-free zone sign? It might as well say, "Terrorists welcome, ready access to undefended scores of innocent children." Please get over the gun control distraction. Ask yourself what stops four men from going into a school with knives or bombs. I know that by the time a threat reaches me on an airplane, there's no time for hesitation, talk, quarter. I want to win more than I can tolerate losing. In 2016, federal agencies are training their law enforcement personnel to respond to active shooter scenarios. Concealed carry permits for civilians are going up. That's great. But we need a more honest discussion. By the time a terrorist or criminal boards a plane with ill intentions, we're past the time for obfuscating their plans or negotiating them down. Either FAMS personnel is on the plane when it takes off, or its passengers and crew are marked for death, and they better know it. The federal air marshal, the passengers, the flight crew, and the pilots are truly the last line of defense. American public spaces and schools need the same approach. Let's cut the feel-good politics and recognize that by the time someone with dangerous plans reaches your doorstep, it's too late to ponder root causes of antisocial behavior. It's time to act. All of the thinking should have been done beforehand. And the level of commitment to stop grotesque violence in its tracks, stone cold dead, has to exceed theirs if protecting the principle is going to succeed. Have no misconceptions. Any outcome at that point will be bloody, ugly, and low down. It's like nothing you've seen in a Hollywood movie, and it's going to be bad breath and fingernail close. But it's a fight that's coming our way whether we get ready for it or not. Let's get ready. My father passed away on December 21, 2007. And as I flew at 30,000 feet, I felt closer and closer to him. It wasn't because of the altitude or the puffy clouds, but because I was keeping my promise to him that I would protect others. Our federal government and agencies have also made that promise to the American people. It's time they dug deep, took the harder, character-driven road, and protected what matters most: the Americans who can't protect themselves.